This is Sustainable East End, a show about land use, energy and water resources, transportation, and the farming and food industries on the eastern end of Long Island. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, co-producer with Tony Ernst. The shellfish population on Long Island's East End is under multiple threats from overdevelopment bordering its bays and estuaries. The town of East Hampton is acting to reverse the decline of a resource that was the basis of the livelihood of generations of its baymen. The town launched its shellfish hatchery in 1989 after a region-wide series of smothering algae blooms or brown tides first appeared in 1985, devastating the area's shellfish resources. Barley Dunn is the director of the town's shellfish hatchery. I spoke with him about the hatchery and its programs. Well, Barley Dunn, welcome to Sustainable East End.
Thanks for having me.
So, tell us exactly what your job title is.
My title is the director of what is called the Aquaculture and Habitat Management Department of the town of East Hampton. But we're pretty much consisted of the shellfish hatchery, the East Hampton Town Shellfish Hatchery.
Now, tell us about this hatchery. Why a hatchery? Why was it established?
Yeah, a lot of people are probably familiar with what happened way back in the mid-80s when we had a big brown tide bloom along the entire East Coast, really. And this was a toxic algae bloom that affected habitat and shellfish. It was toxic to the shellfish, and it bloomed to such a rate that it shaded out the rest of the bottom, and it also killed a lot of the habitat. So eelgrass was wiped out at the same time. A lot of the more sensitive shellfish, such as bay scallops, were wiped out. A lot of the clams and oysters were depleted, so much so that the shellfish population or the shellfish harvest was reduced to about 20% of pre-bloom levels. So after that event, a lot of shellfish hatcheries were started to kind of to try and just kickstart the recovery, if you will, and to try and enhance the stocks of shellfish in local waters. And that was back in the mid-80s, and we started building up our hatchery in the mid-80s and did the first spawn in, like, 1991, I think it was, and we've been going strong ever since.
Why was that brown tide? Why did it happen, and was it the first time that it had happened like that?
It was the first really widespread brown tide, and nobody really knows why it happened. But recently, there have been other harmful algae blooms that have affected both shellfish themselves and the ability for humans to consume shellfish. A lot of people have probably heard about the rust tide or red tide. Those are other types of harmful algae blooms. And the culprit has been narrowed down pretty well to nitrogen, excess nitrogen in the waterways, which is coming from outdated septic tanks primarily, and secondly from just overland runoff from fertilizers and such.
Now, you've established this shellfish hatchery. It's got three different parts. Why don't you describe them to us?
Yeah, so everything starts in the hatchery. We have a hatchery in Montauk on Fort Pond Bay. And right at the beginning of the year, we bring in the brooding animals, or the breeding animals, what we call brood stock, and start to get them ready to spawn. We'll bring them in January, and we'll start to get them ready to spawn in a spring-like condition, what we call a broodstock conditioning tank, and we get them ready to spawn over the course of about anywhere from 5 to 8 weeks. So we're starting early. We're trying to get a jump start on the season, start our spawning in February with oysters. We'll do a few batches of oysters, get them going in the hatchery, and then we'll do a few batches of clams. And then we grow them for as long as we can in the hatchery. We grow all of our own food. We have a big algae culture set up here and a large hatchery room with a bunch of 100-gallon tanks and setting tanks and all kinds of good stuff. And come April, we're starting to move stuff out to our second location, which is a nursery on Mile Harbor in East Hampton. That is a land-based upwelling system where we just use ambient bay water, and that's so we don't need to create any food. We don't adjust for temperature. We just pump that bay water through the shellfish seed, and once they get to a certain size there, around about June or so, then we can move them out to our field site, which is in Napeague Harbor, and that's kind of where we finish. It's similar to, you know, land-based terrestrial plants. They'll start in a nursery, and then they move out to the field, and we basically do the same thing. We grow them until they stop growing or slow down growing, and then we seed them all throughout town, public bottom.
So they eat algae, and yet algae can also kill them. So what's the difference between the different kinds of algae that, you know, the good ones and the bad ones?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's well, luckily for us out here in East Hampton, we are extremely lucky because our waters are very clean. We have the oceanic influence because we're out on the East End, and we have just healthy waterways because we do have a pretty healthy shellfish population. So as long as the water is green, we're good to go. If we see or hear of any rust-colored waters or red-colored waters, those are the harmful algaes. Some, like I said, some can affect humans and some can affect the shellfish. And if it gets to the point where we need to move shellfish, we could do that. Luckily, we have never had to do that. It's be pretty difficult to do if we had to do it, but we could do it if we had to. So it's kind of luck of the draw. You know, if folks are growing shellfish and a harmful algae comes through, you just either move them or you just keep your fingers crossed and hope that it passes quickly.
So now that I visited all three nursery sites, and we're going to have photos of those that I took up on sustainableeastend.blogspot.com, our website,
nice. After
this interview. But at the first site we went to, which is, I guess, the second site for the operation, the one that's by the Harbor Marina on Gann Road in East Hampton, there's an oyster farm. Tell us about that oyster farm.
Oh, yeah. That is our community oyster garden. We started community oyster gardening last year with a pilot project, and it's designed off of Cornell Cooperative Extension's SPAT program, which was started about 10 years ago. Basically, it allows people from the public to grow some of their own oyssters. And they're limited to 1,000 oysters. And we started it with East Hampton residents last year. We had about 15 participants. And the way it works is they get 1,000 oysters in July. And before that, we provide lectures and just give people a background on what it is they're getting into. You know, you wouldn't want to start a bee colony or get into any other hobbies without some knowledge. So we have some lectures in the spring, and teach them about the biology and how we grow them, and talk to them about predators and fouling, and basically how to grow their oysters and what to look out for. So they get that seed in July, and then we schedule maintenance sessions every 3 weeks or so, because just like your home garden, you need to weed it, and the oyster garden also needs to be quote-unquote weeded, because we'll get fouling organisms that set onto the oyster bags. The oysters are kept in fine mesh bags, and if they're just left alone, they'll be smothered by the quote-unquote weeds of the marine environment, which is just, you know, other macroalgaes. There's tunicates and other things that'll clog up the bags. Anyone who has a boat or a dock or even a pool knows what I'm talking about. So you want to maintain that gear and maintain those oysters to get the best growth. And so the gardeners grow their stuff from July to October. Once the water cools down to about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, the shellfish pretty much stop feeding, and they kind of go into a hibernation mode for the winter. So there's no use in continuing to maintain them. So we set them up for the overwinter. We basically sink them to a point where won't be disrupted by the ice. And all the while, people that started last year are able to harvest some oysters and take them home and eat them, or they can continue to grow them. And, you know, all the while they're doing this, these oysters are filtering the water. The cages themselves are providing a great habitat for grass shrimp, nursery fish. We get baby blackfish in there, baby sea bass, all kinds of other stuff, crabs. And it's a great opportunity for people that want to get out and in the water and want to become stewards of the marine environment.
And so they're basically creating a kind of ecosystem that helps the sustainability of the waters. Is that right?
Yeah, basically anything you add to the waterway, it's kind of like picture an open field that's previously just grass. If you plant a tree in that field, stuff is going to be attracted to it, whether it's birds, squirrels, chipmunks, because there's cover there, there's habitat. And so when we float things out in the bay, it basically creates the same thing. It becomes this aggregation device where, you know, these juvenile nursery fish can hide out and be protected from predators. So stuff just is attracted to it, and all the while the shellfish that we're growing are filtering the water. One adult oyster can filter about 50 gallons of water a day. So extrapolate that out to a nice healthy population, whether it's a oyster garden or an oyster farm or the areas that we seed with oysters, and getting a lot of natural filtration and natural habitat created.
And how do they handle things like, you know, algae blooms? Can they handle that? Or do they help? In other words, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, you talked about nitrogen pollution in the water. How do they deal with that?
Well, it doesn't actually affect, excess nitrogen doesn't affect the shellfish themselves. It doesn't affect anything really other than it's basically a fertilizer for algae. It's basically an excess fertilizer that, with the state of excess nitrogen, we're providing an opportunity for these harmful algae blooms to bloom. But the other benefit of having shellfish present is that they actually graze down on some of those harmful algaes. And by having the shellfish present, that's another way to mitigate against harmful algaes. So that's one thing that recently the governor announced a big shellfish initiative where he wants to work with other hatcheries and shellfish growers and get a whole bunch, hundreds of millions more shellfish out into the waters in areas that have succumbed to harmful algae blooms, in the hopes that those shellfish will actually graze down on that harmful algae and reduce the recurrence of harmful algae blooms.
Wow, that's awesome. And aren't oysters also being used in, say, New York Harbor to build up oyster reefs that might be a buffer against a storm surge? And I wonder if that's something that could also be done here.
Yeah, oyster reefs are, it's a really great way to stabilize the shoreline. You know, look at a plain sandy beach. There's really not much resistance there against storms. But if you have an oyster reef, which is a much harder substrate, it can help stabilize the shoreline and combat against beating waves. And they are working on that in the city, both to stabilize the shoreline and to help clean the waters and try and rejuvenate the old oyster population. You know, Manhattan, if anybody who's read The Big Oyster, which is a great book, highly recommend it, Manhattan used to be just covered in oysters. And, you know, all the while, like I said, filtering all that water. It's a big task, but they're working on it. There's a project called the Billion Oyster Project, and their goal is to plant a billion oysters in around Manhattan.
And before we leave the oysters, is there a waiting list to be on that oyster farm, the oyster garden?
Yeah, we have a list. We're hoping to expand next year. Right now we have a garden in Three Mile Harbor and another garden in Hog Creek, and hopefully we'll expand into another harbor. It's looking most likely that it'll be Accabonic Harbor. So, yeah, I'm definitely taking names, making a list, and the more people I have interested, the more likely we'll be to expand. So that'd be great.
Well, count me in.
All right.
And I guess you can sign up online. Where does one sign up?
Yeah, best things to do is either call me or email me. Email me is best. That way I have people's email addresses. My email is jdunne, J-D-U-N-N-E, at ehamptonny.gov.
And we are talking with Barley Dunn. He is the director of, and I'm just going to say, the East Hampton Fish Hatchery, because I don't remember that much longer title that you have.
That's fine.
You are listening to Sustainable East End on WPKN. So moving on from oysters, there is an other site that I visited, and we went out. Tell us where we went and what that was all about.
So after the nursery, you came to our field grow-out site in Napeague Harbor, which is really that's where we finish up the growing. And we have, out there, we have about 200 oyster cages. Each cage holds about 6 bags. So there are about 2.5 million oyster seed floating in that harbor. And they're all around about 2 inches right now, which is an ideal seeding size. And once all these storms pass, we'll probably commence with seeding. And basically all that entails is pulling those oyster bags out, dumping them into totes, take some measurements, take some counts, and then we'll pick our spots and drive around in a boat and throw them onto a nice hard bottom. Oysters, unlike clams and scallops, are unable to move. Once they pass through their larval metamorphosis stage, they're unable to move. So it's really important that we place oysters on a nice hard bottom where they don't run the risk of being buried in sediment. So, and also at the Napeague site there, we have a couple hundred thousand bay scallops that we're growing. And those were being grown in pearl nets on buoy strings. I think you saw some of those. And those we will actually overwinter. And we'll overwinter them in a nice sheltered pond right near Napeague there, and then we'll seed them in the spring. That way they're not subject to dredging activity when scallop season opens up. We'll just protect them until about April of next year, and then seed them densely into quasi-sanctuary areas where we hope they'll spawn next summer and produce some more offspring.
Now, how is your effort there working to enhance the local commercial baymen?
Yeah, there's quite a few guys and a few ladies that are digging up oysters and clams commercially. Oysters fetch a prettier penny than clams, so a lot of them are going after the oysters, which is great because, you know, we want them to be harvested. We don't want oysters necessarily staying out there for too long, because if you have areas of really dense oysters, that's a really good opportunity for disease to come in and wipe them all out. So it's great that they're being picked through, and some are harvested and sold. Others are left behind to spawn. So there is some of that happening. Clams also, we have a lot of good clam bottom. And all of this is public information, by the way. We produce annual reports, and we draw out these nice maps that are color-coded, stating exactly where we put stuff. So there's no secret. But, there's definitely some folks commercially taking advantage of the product that we produce.
And scallops, come in a pretty penny also.
When we have a good bay scallop harvest, which hasn't really been, unfortunately, since 2014, we have high hopes for this year. They do fetch a pretty penny because they're relatively rare, and everybody loves their scallops come fall. You know, it's one of the highlights of living out here is scallop season, taking home some of those meats.
How do people get? Do people have to get a license in order to harvest these?
Yeah, any resident of East Hampton can just go to Town Hall, get themselves a permit, and that allows them to go out every day, all day. And the beauty of our program is that you can reap the benefit. You know, it's very easy to go out to a nice clamming spot and get as many as 100 clams in an hour or a couple hundred oysters in an hour, and the payback is great for that permit.
Wow, that's amazing. How much is a permit?
I think it's 15 or 20, so it's pretty negligible, especially when you can take home your dinner.
Exactly. So now I want to ask you a bit about the health of the waters. You said we have some of the cleanest waters here, but we are confronting issues of climate change and warming of the waters. And I wonder if you've seen any impact of warming waters on the local fisheries and the shellfish.
Not necessarily the shellfish. One of the things we're seeing is, at least I'm speculating that we're seeing some effects of acidity. You know, sometimes we see corroded shells in some of our young clams, and I think that's because of an increased acidity condition in the waters. Mostly what the warmer water is doing is wiping out the eelgrass and not allowing it to come back, because the upper threshold temperature for eelgrass is 25 degrees Celsius, which is about 80 degrees Fahrenheit. So if the water reaches that temperature and is sustained for a while, it can actually wipe out eelgrass beds. And I think that's the biggest hurdle that needs to be overcome in order to restore eelgrass, which is, you know, it goes hand in hand with shellfish and habitat restoration, because without that eelgrass or some sort of cover on the bottom, bay scallops, natural bay scallops, are going to be hard-pressed to survive, because when they settle onto the bottom as baby bay scallops, they just get devoured, because it's like a barren desert out there on the bay bottom with no algae cover on the bottom. So without that sort of habitat, whether it's eelgrass or Codium, which is the Sputnik grass, the other, it's an invasive grass, but it does well in some areas, and scallops will do well in that type of bottom. But that's the biggest thing I see with warming waters. Doesn't seem to be affecting our shellfish so much. And as a matter of fact, it might help them because it prolongs our growing season. So it's not necessarily affecting them adversely just yet.
Well, and tell our listeners, what is the connection between why is the water more acid, basically, and that the impact on shells?
All the CO2 that is being emitted into the atmosphere from, you know, things we do every day, driving our cars, the industry of the developed world, the majority of that is actually being absorbed into the ocean. So CO2 is acidic. So when that CO2 is absorbed into the ocean, it's lowering the pH, therefore making the water more acidic. And when shellfish are developing, they have a super, super thin shell, and they rely on calcium carbonate to develop their shell. And if the water is too acidic, they can't make that calcium carbonate shell because it just basically dissolves in the acidic water. It's more of a problem out west, in the West Coast, because they have much deeper waters. We have this continental shelf on the East Coast where the algae, the actual natural water body, when microalgae or phytoplankton is photosynthesizing, it's actually increasing the pH. So there's this constant battle between the acidic waters and the CO2 being absorbed and the algae naturally raising the pH through photosynthesis. So we suffer the problem much less over here. And the West Coast has really succumbed to it because they have deeper continental shelf over there where they have upwelling of the waters. So the deeper water is being welled up, and that water is more acidic. So it's much more of a problem out west, but I think it's only a matter of time before we're seeing it over here.
And you know, as the water's warm, I mean, I wasn't aware that our waters even got above 80 degrees here, but as they do warm, are there any alternatives, more hardy alternatives to eelgrass? Or, you know, are there any remedies, basically, that are being worked upon that can provide that kind of natural habitat?
I think Cornell Cooperative Extension, one of their main tasks is eelgrass restoration, and one of the things they've looked into doing is bringing actually southern strains of eelgrass up here to the north, because the southern strains are obviously more hardened to the warmer waters, and I think they're working on that. I'm not sure, I haven't been updated as to the efficacy of that, but that might be a solution. Otherwise, just like this summer actually was really good because we had a relatively cool summer and that upper temperature threshold really wasn't maintained for that long. So hopefully the eelgrass got themselves a little boost this summer, because it really wasn't, we really didn't have super warm waters as we have in the past. You know, the last few summers have been record breakers, but this year it really wasn't. So hopefully the eelgrass can get a foothold and come back.
Well, that would be wonderful. And
sure would.
Well, Barley Dunn, you are the director of East Hampton Shellfish Hatchery. This has just been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Sustainable East End, and we'll be sure to put up links to the website for the Shellfish Hatchery.
Thanks very much for having me. That was fun.
This is Sustainable East End. We talked with Barley Dunn of East Hampton Town's Shellfish Hatchery. More information about the hatchery and the town's aquaculture projects is available online at ehamptonny.gov/149/aquaculture, or just go to sustainableeastend.blogspot.com for the link. Listen to Sustainable East End on the third Wednesday each month on WPKN or online at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and me, Francesca Rhiannon.